From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a history of lesbian subcultures in 20th century America and what they reveal about American attitudes toward class and gender. We'll talk with Lillian Faderman, author of a new book on the subject. Also, It's My Party and Judy's Turn to Cry aren't exactly songs of sisterhood, but you could consider You Don't Own Me a proto-feminist anthem. Coming up, we talk with singer Leslie Gore about those early hits from the 60s and her new cabaret act. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg considers some of the expressions tossed around in the aftermath of the Clarence Thomas hearings. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Bush is calling the new civil rights bill that he will sign a new standard against discrimination. The president called the bill a source of pride for him and disputed others who said he really didn't want a civil rights bill after all.
I remember standing out there in the Rose Garden with Attorney General Thornburg more than a year and a half ago to make an unshakable commitment to the nation's civil rights leaders that I wanted a non-quota civil rights bill that I could sign. And assuming there are no changes in the bill as agreed to last night, we now have such a bill. And my promise will be kept, and I will enthusiastically sign this bill.
The president also says he's looking forward to the Mideast peace talks next week in Spain. He says that the United States is a committed partner to finding peace, but that only the parties themselves can achieve it. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir has released a list of the 14 members of the delegation he'll lead at the Mideast peace talks. Foreign Minister David Levy, who had been expected to head the group, is not on the list. Paul Adams reports for the BBC from Jerusalem that the makeup of the delegation reflects a solidly right-wing outlook.
Mr. Shamir's team for the Madrid peace talks contains the anticipated array of Likud party hardliners, together with a sprinkling of seasoned civil servants with expertise in Middle Eastern, American, and European affairs. As expected, the one notable absentee is the Foreign Minister, David Levy. He pulled out in disgust when Mr. Shamir announced on Wednesday that he personally planned to lead the delegation. The Foreign Ministry will be represented in Madrid. Yosef Adas is the acting director general, and Eitan Bensur is one of the ministry's most experienced civil servants, thought to enjoy particularly good relations with the American State Department. Mr. Levy's deputy and rival, Benjamin Netanyahu, is also on the list, adding insult to the foreign minister's injury. Apart from the prime minister's advisor on Druze affairs and a representative from the army, the rest of the 14-member delegation is solidly hardline.
Paul Adams reporting. The Spanish government says it's mobilized 12,000 police officers, including paramilitary civil guards, in preparation for the talks. The Interior Minister is conducting daily strategy sessions with other cabinet members to prepare for the Mideast Peace Conference. Tanks are already in position at Madrid's Barajas Airport. Although the conference starts on Wednesday, the co-sponsors, Presidents Bush and Gorbachev, will arrive early to meet with each other. The National Association of Realtors says home sales fell 4.3% in September. The group says those who did get a house were mostly first-time homebuyers, taking advantage of favorable mortgage rates. But the association says those same rates haven't spurred much interest among those trading up to more expensive homes. On Wall Street, the Dow was down 14 points at 3002.23. Trading is active. This is NPR. United Nations officials today said that Iraq's chemical weapons arsenal is so vast and dangerous that inspection teams won't destroy all of the weapons until at least 1993. Rolf Achaeus, the head of the special commission in charge of disposing of the weapons, said the destruction was a great risk. In April, Iraq said it had about 12,000 chemical weapons, but inspectors have found about 46,000 loaded weapons, along with 79,000 unfilled munitions. The UN Security Council is getting close to choosing a new Secretary General. A second straw poll is expected to be held today. Linda Fasulo reports.
In the first straw poll on Monday, several African candidates were eliminated and five new names were added. The five include two prime ministers, Canada's Brian Mulroney and Norway's Gro Harlem Brundtland, Foreign Minister Hans Vandenbroek of Holland, and Thorvald Stoltenberg of Norway, and senior UN official Prince Sadruddin Aga Khan. The poll is contentious because African countries have accused council members of racism for adding the new non-African names. They say the top UN post should rotate among all geographical regions and believe it's their turn. Current favorites for UN chief include Mulroney, Brundtland, Stoltenberg, and Egyptian Deputy Prime Minister Boutros Ghali, listed as an African candidate. But some African diplomats prefer the finance minister of Zimbabwe, Bernard Chidzero. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo reporting.
For most people in the United States, this weekend will provide them with an extra hour, possibly, of sleep. On Sunday morning at 2 a.m., most of the United States will switch back to standard time. If you are on daylight savings time, remember, set your clock back an hour at 2 a.m. Sunday morning. The adage is, spring forward, fall back. A light earthquake hit Washington State this morning at 8:42 Pacific time. The U.S. Geological Survey measured the quake at 3.5 on the Richter scale. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's difficult to document a culture which is forced to remain hidden. Until the gay liberation movement, there was very little in the way of gay history. My guest, Lillian Faderman, is one of the writers who has been telling the story of this formerly invisible subculture. Faderman is a professor at California State University in Fresno and has written extensively about lesbian literature and history. Her new book, Odd Girls and Twilight Lovers, is a study of lesbian subcultures through the 20th century. And she's found these subcultures have a lot to tell us about changing views of class, morality, and gender in America. In the 1950s, for instance, Faderman says the lesbian subculture was defined by class.
For example, middle-class women didn't dare generally to frequent the gay bars. Lesbian bars in those days were called gay girls' bars. They didn't dare participate in that visible aspect of the subculture. And so their subculture was often made up of private parties and dinner parties and things that were much less visible than what working-class lesbians and young lesbians did. Young lesbians often went to gay girls' bars. Those bars frequently encouraged the establishment of butch and femme roles and role-playing and relationships, such as tended not to exist in such an obvious way among middle-class women.
Why do you think that in the 1950s there was so much emphasis on butch and femme roles within
the working
relationships
class
between
community
women
and the young community? I want to emphasize not
so in the middle class.
Among middle-class women. But I think it was partly because roles in the parent society were just so pronounced, mm-hmm. so insistent. That is, men had to be manly men and women had to be very feminine women. And I think that young lesbians and working class lesbians were very influenced by the parent society. It's not true, I'm sure, for all women who found themselves in butch and femme relationships. I'm sure some of those women felt that it simply came natural to them. They were doing what was right for them. But within the bar scene, women who didn't feel particularly masculine or particularly feminine were frequently encouraged to choose one role or another and play that role within the relationship.
Well, you interviewed lots of women for your new book. Did you find that a lot of women did feel that they didn't fit in either butch or femme and had to choose one and felt uncomfortable after they did?
Yeah, I talk about some interesting stories that I was told in the course of these interviews. One woman, for example, told me that one night she was going to a bar to meet another woman who identified as a butch, and so she dressed in a very feminine way to be a counterpart to this other woman. The other woman didn't show up, and so the woman I interviewed decided that she would go to another bar, and in the car she changed clothes. She changed from her feminine clothes to her butch clothes because she said she just wanted to meet another woman, and butches had more opportunity to be aggressive, to introduce themselves, to to take the dominant position in a relationship that they would start in a bar. And so for her, it was extremely flexible.
Did she describe both outfits for you, by the way?
Yes, the femme outfit consisted of dangling earrings and high heels and a skirt, and the butch outfit consisted of penny loafers, which were very in the 50s, and she slicked her hair back in a ducktail, which was part of the guise, and she put a kind of T-shirt on and a sweater over it, and I think those pants were called in those days duck trousers, but it was almost a butch uniform that was popular in Los Angeles in the 1950s.
I feel compelled to point out that if you substitute the hair grease for mousse, you have the kind of basic way men and women dress today.
Right, yes, I think that's a good point. Now, of course, we have
except for the penny loafers. I don't know about the penny loafers.
Guys, right.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, my guest is Lillian Faderman, and she chairs the Women's Studies Department at California State University at Fresno. She's the author of a new book called Odd Girls and Twilight Lovers, A History of Lesbian Life in 20th Century America. Well, in talking about lesbian subcultures, there's a really interesting and dramatic change that takes place in the latter part of the 1960s, both because of the counterculture and its attitudes towards love, and also because of the feminist movement. Let's start with the counterculture and what was sometimes called free love. Did that put same-sex love into a different context?
Yes, I think it did, particularly coming out of phenomena such as the hippie movement, the new left, the general tenor of the times in which experimentation was encouraged, the growth of the second wave of the feminist movement, and then, of course, at the end of the 1960s, the Stonewall Rebellion, the beginning of the gay liberation movement. I think that the 60s gave birth to a whole different kind of lesbian from the women that I first knew when I came out as a lesbian in the lesbian bars of the mid-1950s.
What are some of those differences?
Well, I want to distinguish, first of all, between two sets of lesbians, some lesbians who worked within the gay liberation movement, who felt that where they hurt most was as homosexuals, and it was really to their benefit to bring about reforms to get rid of discrimination against homosexuals. There were other lesbians, however, who came out through feminism or who identified mostly as feminists, and they felt where they hurt most was not necessarily as homosexuals, but as women. That is, even if homosexuals had all sorts of freedoms, they would be discriminated against as women. And those women very often became feminists first and then radical feminists and then saw lesbianism as the only logical conclusion to feminism. And they became political lesbians first. That is, their attitude was any woman could choose to be a lesbian.
But don't you think it's interesting that in the late 1960s, perhaps for the first time in history, you have sexuality becoming, in part, a political and cultural decision?
Yes. Yes, I think that's true. And again, I think it comes out of the wonderful ferment and upheaval of the 1960s, where we felt that anything was possible, that one could choose to live a lesbian lifestyle and that it was a viable political and cultural choice.
You say in your book that since so many women decided to become lesbian to get away from sexist political or emotional relationships, that lesbianism became seen by some women as a cure-all for all the ills of sexism. And I wonder what kind of impossible expectations you think that put on certain lesbian relationships.
Yeah, I think that's a good question. It seems to me that many women who became lesbians during 1970s expected those relationships to be utopian, to be perfect in every way. And of course, lesbian relationships are human relationships, and there's no way that human relationships can be simply perfect forever. And I think a number of those women were disappointed. Many of them then developed more realistic expectations and have remained lesbians. Others felt that since it was hard to live as a lesbian in a culture that was primarily heterosexual and relationships weren't perfect, they may as well go back to heterosexuality again. There's a term for those women, incidentally. They're called has-beens.
You say something in the book that I think is very funny. I'm not sure if you meant it to be funny or not. But you say in the 1950s, there was a lot of role-playing between butch and femme. In the 1970s, so many lesbian feminists just saw themselves as butch, just dressed butch.
Right. I don't think they would have identified themselves specifically as butch if they were asked seriously, are you butch or femme? But I think the style was androgynous. I think that many radical feminists, and certainly lesbian feminists as part of the radical feminist movement, felt that it was playing into patriarchy to wear high heels and dresses and makeup and all of those artifacts of heterosexuality. Women did it simply to please men, and as lesbian feminists, of course, they would have nothing of it. And so their style tended to be very androgynous. They didn't have elaborate hairdos as opposed to heterosexual women. They refused any kind of makeup. And they wore clothing that they thought was comfortable and practical.
What kind of splits do you think there were in the 1970s between lesbians who came out primarily for political reasons, to get away from sexism, and lesbians for whom it was really more of a basic sexual orientation?
Yeah, there was some conflict during the 1970s on the basis of those different ways to come at lesbianism. I think that many women who had been lesbians long before the 1970s, old gays as they were called for a while, really felt that young lesbian feminists just didn't know what it was all about, that they came into lesbianism in an era of relative freedom, really vast freedom from the perspective of women who came out in the 1950s, and they took for granted all of these privileges. They had no way of identifying with the struggles of older lesbians, and so there was a lot of resentment on the one hand. But on the other hand, I interviewed a number of women who had come out in the 1950s and became lesbian feminists in the 70s, and they thought that they had died and gone to heaven, that you know, suddenly the whole world was open to them, that there were all of these wonderful cultural representations, such as women's music and women's novels. And what I mean by women is lesbian. The term was generally used synonymously at the height of lesbian feminism. Women's publishing houses, women's coffee houses, all sorts of cultural places to go and to be a lesbian.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Lillian Faderman. She's the author of the new book, Odd Girls and Twilight Lovers, A History of Lesbian Life in 20th Century America. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Lillian Faderman is my guest, and she chairs the Women's Studies Department at California State University at Fresno, and she's written a new history of lesbian life in 20th century America. What is happening today with younger lesbians who are coming of age now, who are in their late teens or in their early 20s, their late 20s? Do you see a different kind of subculture emerging?
Yeah, I really envy younger lesbians, and I'm very happy for them. I don't know what the future is going to bring. I think if there's an economic depression in this country, and it looks like we're very close to one, there may be all sorts of reactions against any kind of diversity, and undoubtedly homosexuals will suffer from those reactions. But short of that, it seems to me that younger lesbians are coming into a much more open society, and in all ways more open than what I experienced coming out in the 1950s, and even more open than what lesbian feminists experienced, because I think there's much more choice now. One can be a lesbian feminist, as women were in the 1970s. One can be involved in a butch and femme relationship, as women, working class and young lesbians were in the 1950s. One could be a lipstick lesbian, which is a term that was current for a while in the late 1980s. And
what's this? Yeah.
A lipstick lesbian dresses in high heels and skirts and makeup, and still calls herself a lesbian, doesn't think there's any kind of uniform, as she would put it, that she has to don. There isn't any sort of appearance that she has to plug into. She can just do it her own way.
You write in the book that you believe that lesbians aren't necessarily born different. In other words, that it really might be a choice that you make, as opposed to just something inherent in your makeup.
Right. I really think that the Kinsey scale, established by Alfred Kinsey in the early 1950s, is very telling about human sexuality. Kinsey created a scale from 0 to 6. 0 meant a person who was totally heterosexual. 6 meant a person who was totally homosexual. And what he discovered is that there were very few 0s and very few 6s. People who identified as heterosexual tended to be 1 or 2 on the Kinsey scale. That is, they had some homosexual experience. People who identified as homosexual tended to be 4 or 5 on the Kinsey scale. They had some heterosexual experience. What that indicates is that people are really diverse within their own lives sexually, and at any given time, a person can be heterosexual primarily or homosexual primarily. I think that's very good evidence of the fact that one isn't simply born heterosexual or born homosexual.
And you don't think there should be pressure on people to worry about consistency in their choices?
No, not at all. No, I think it's wonderful if people could feel open about who they are and open to express themselves according to whatever else is happening in their lives at a particular time.
You came out in the 1950s. Did you fit into any of the subcultures that you described earlier?
Well, I experienced various subcultures. I first was brought by a gay boy, as we called gay men in those days, to a gay girls' bar that was a working class bar where butches and femmes were in very different kinds of roles, really made distinctions between them. About a year later, I was taken by another friend to not a gay girl's bar, but a gay woman's cocktail lounge. It was one of the few middle-class lesbian bars in Los Angeles, the city in which I lived at that time. And there the women didn't fit into butch and femme roles, at least not in any visible kind of way. The women generally wore tailored suits and high heels and makeup and were fairly uniformly feminine, at least in their visible appearance, although what they did in private might have been very different from their visible appearance. And so I sort of lived in both cultures for a period of time.
What made you comfortable and uncomfortable about each?
Well, I think what made me most uncomfortable about the working class and young lesbian culture, my first introduction to lesbian life, was the insistence, the public insistence within those bars that one had to choose an identity, had to choose a self-presentation. It had to be either butch or femme. But what was so wonderful about that subculture was the bravery of those women. They risked a lot to be in those bars. They were really subject to raids by the vice squad practically weekly. In fact, I interview a woman from Worcester, or rather I quote an interview of a woman from Worcester, Massachusetts, who says that raids were so frequent every Friday and Saturday night in the working class bar that she used to go to, that they would make a joke of it. They would say, "Hurry up and finish your beer because we're going for a ride." That is, the paddy wagon was going to pull up momentarily and take them off. And it must have taken for women in a situation like that a terrific amount of bravery to risk being there, to create a kind of lesbian geography, to realize that they had to establish a place for themselves. And so that was really admirable, I think.
So when you were expected to choose butch or femme, which did you become?
It varied, I think, from week to week, depending on a particular mood. But I don't think I was ever especially comfortable in either of those roles. I was probably more comfortable in the gay women's cocktail lounge, where one didn't have to choose a specific role, at least in terms of self-presentation in a social situation.
What made you uncomfortable about that context, though?
I think what made me uncomfortable is those women really seemed to be much more frightened about who they were than working class and young women. They really felt that they had a lot more to lose. They often wouldn't certainly not give their last names upon meeting someone in a bar, and frequently not even give their real first names, because they felt that it was just so dangerous to be in a gay bar in the 1950s. And of course, for many of them, it was not paranoia. It was at least a very well-justified paranoia. They were in danger if they had any sort of government position, if they worked for local government or state government as a teacher, for instance, or a social worker or a librarian. They really could lose their jobs and their livelihood if they were discovered to be lesbian.
When did the gay liberation movement start to directly affect your life?
I think it did as soon as I read about the Stonewall Rebellion in 1969. That was so incredible that finally here were some homosexuals that would not simply stand for being taken off in a paddy wagon and booked and held overnight in jail and demeaned. At the same time, or immediately after that, there was the establishment of the lesbian feminist movement, when suddenly thousands and thousands of women were saying what I had felt my whole life, that is, they were taking a feminist approach to politics, analyzing the world in feminist terms. And that, too, was extremely liberating for me.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. I enjoyed it.
My guest has been Lillian Faderman, and she's the author of the new book, Odd Girls and Twilight Lovers, A History of Lesbian Life in 20th Century America. She also chairs the Women's Studies Department at California State University at Fresno. This is Fresh Air. Thank you.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In 1963, she was 16, her hair was in a flip, and her first record rose to number one on the charts. Coming up, we talk with Leslie Gore about her hits from the 60s, like It's My Party, Judy's Turn to Cry, and You Don't Own Me. And we find out what she's been up to since then. Also, linguist Jeffrey Nunberg thinks about some of the catchphrases he heard tossed about after the Clarence Thomas hearings. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Bush today said a compromise civil rights bill is positive and sound. The measure was hammered out last night, ending a two-year stalemate between Congress and the White House. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The president said he couldn't be more pleased with the measure as he posed for pictures with Senate Minority Leader Robert Dole and Senator John Danforth, who helped reach the agreement. Mr. Bush called the compromise bill good for the country.
This is very, very positive work, and it's not a partisan thing. It's a strong effort to hit against discrimination in the workplace. So I'm very, very pleased. I couldn't be more pleased with it.
Just what exact changes were made in the plan to make it acceptable to the White House have not been revealed, but administration officials say they are supporting the measure because it is not a quota bill. This is Brian Naylor at the White House.
The Yugoslav army has apparently launched new mortar attacks near Dubrovnik today. Meanwhile, Serbia has rejected a revised European Community peace plan, dimming hopes of ending the 4 months of fighting. Croatian radio said the Federal Army also fired mortars on two small towns south of Dubrovnik. The attacks defied a truce agreed upon yesterday after the army took over nearby Kupari. 10 ceasefires have failed to end battles that have killed more than 1,000 people since Croatia declared independence from Yugoslavia on June 25th. The ongoing slump in the auto industry could mean no bonuses for top executives this year. From Detroit, Don Gagne has this report.
The big three domestic automakers are expected to combine to lose more than $5 billion during 1991, making it the worst financial year in the history of the industry. So it should come as little surprise that General Motors Chairman Robert Stempel is saying the company probably won't have any money to award top managers at year's end. A year in the red has not always meant no executive bonuses at GM or elsewhere, but this year, according to Stempel, GM's Incentive Compensation Committee could decide against bonuses based on huge losses resulting from slower-than-expected new car sales. During the third quarter alone, GM reported more than $1 billion in red ink. Meeting with reporters today, Stempel said the slow nature of the economic recovery has consumers nervous, adding that even those with money are reluctant to spend it. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
American Express Company stock dropped sharply today as investors learned the financial company lost earnings of 91% in the third quarter of this year. Analysts say the company was hemorrhaging from losses in its credit card business. The earnings results reported after the stock market closed yesterday were far worse than expected. The losses reflect the impact of the recession and personal bankruptcies on the company's Optima credit card business. Stocks closed lower on Wall Street today. The Dow lost more than 11 points to end at 3004.92. Declines led advances in active trading. This is NPR News. Belgium and France today joined the United States in urging their citizens to flee Zaire. Rioters in Zaire burned a villa belonging to President Mobutu Sese Seko and ransacked the home of the new prime minister. It is still unclear whether President Mobutu has lost control of the army or, as the opposition charges, has engineered the unrest as an excuse to impose a military government. About 2,000 French and Belgian paratroopers went into Zaire last month to protect foreigners from rioting soldiers who took over the capital. The bidding for the failed executive life insurance company is nearing its climax. Today in Los Angeles, the final bids are being reviewed by a judge who's been overseeing the company since the state took it over. With more on the story, here's Harry Lynn of member station KQED in San Francisco.
Judge Kurt Lewin has been administering the sale of the insurer that collapsed last April under a $6 billion junk bond portfolio. In all, 8 different bids were made, and yesterday, the California Insurance Commissioner endorsed one of them. The commissioner recommended the bid by the National Organization of Guarantee Associations, a collection of insurer-funded agencies in 47 states that cover company failures such as executive life. The national organization has been given 10 days to prove that it can both purchase the company and run it successfully. In the meantime, 2 other bidders still up for consideration can shore up their offers. One is from a French investment group, and another from a partnership among Chicago businessman Sam Zell, San Francisco investment firm Hellman & Friedman, and insurance executive Jack Byrne. Both of those groups say they still think they can win the sale. Ultimately, Judge Lewin has the final say. For National Public Radio, I'm Harry Lynn in San Francisco.
The U.S. Marshals Service says a 10-week federal sweep for dangerous criminals has netted nearly 1,500 violent felons. The operation was carried out with the help of officers from 65 agencies. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. You know who's doing a cabaret act at Rainbow and Stars, one of New York's top rooms? Leslie Gore. Everyone who listened to Top 40 radio in the mid-60s knew her hits. It's My Party, Judy's Turn to Cry, She's a Fool, You Don't Own Me, That's the Way Boys Are, and Maybe I Know. You know who produced her? Quincy Jones. These were some of his big pop records long before the Michael Jackson days. In Gore's cabaret act, she sings Porter and Gershwin, as well as the songs that made her famous. She's still singing this one, my favorite. It's a song she chose herself.
At the time, I know I chose it because I liked the strength in the lyric. But for me, it was not a song about being a woman. It was a song about being a person and what was involved with that. Of course, it got picked up as an anthem for women, which makes me very proud. And today, when I sing that song, I don't know, maybe it's after the Anita Hill hearings and a number of other things that have seem to be happening in our world, You Don't Own Me takes on a whole other set of meanings for me now.
Yeah, I know a lot of people have come to see it as a proto-feminist anthem.
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't think of it that way when you were recording it?
I didn't. What I was impressed with was the strength. I've always hated wimpy woman. I've never understood it. So when I first heard this piece of material, I knew it was one I wanted to do.
Now, how did you choose it? How was it offered to you?
This is a great story. I was actually practically kidnapped in a hotel up in the Catskills, Grossinger's, when it was still in existence. I had gone up there to do some promotion for WAEB, and Gene Kay, who was a major disc jockey in the Allentown area, and I was sitting at the pool, and 2 young men from Philadelphia, John Madera and Dave White, literally took me into one of the cabanas and played me You Don't Own Me on just a guitar and sang it for me. I fell in love with it immediately, and I made an appointment for them to come into New York on Monday and sing it for Quincy Jones, who also loved it.
So they let you choose your own songs. I mean, I don't know if everybody had that opportunity.
Well, With Quincy and I, we, as a matter of fact, Quincy was into the show at the Rainbow and Stars a couple of Friday evenings ago, and we had a wonderful reunion, and one of the things we talked about was a couple of the songs that he made me record that I never wanted to record. And what we would do at that time is he would find something or say he didn't want me to record something, and we would negotiate it out. I would do the song I didn't want to do for him, and he would do the song ostensibly he didn't want to do but for me.
So which songs did he make you do?
Oh, there was a song called Sometimes I Wish I Were a Boy. I really hated that one. And there was another one called I Struck a Match. Oh, it was hateful. And as a matter of fact, we had a terrific joke about it. He got this fantastic velvet box from Cartier and presented it to me the day that the album was released with I Struck a Match on it. And I opened it up, and it was a huge wooden match.
Need I point out, these songs were not hits.
Need you point out, indeed. Of course not. I knew my stuff.
Now, what's the story behind how you made your first record?
Well, it's an unusual story, but not in showbiz terms. I was studying with a vocal coach in the New York area, a man by the name of Myron Earnhardt, and one day I went in to do my lesson, and he said to me that he had booked a tiny recording studio just upstairs from him. We took the piano player and went upstairs and did, I think, four piano voice demos, pretty much one, two, three, four, right in a row. And when I left there that day, I literally had two what looked like 78-size records and two songs, one on each side. And we pressed up a couple of these, and as it happened, a man by the name of Joe Glazer, who was the president of ABC Booking, which was a booking agency, met Irving Green, who was president of Mercury Records, and played him my demos. Irving was impressed with the fact that I was 16 and had an interesting feel for music, and he needed a project for Quincy Jones, so he put us together.
Was this the Joe Glazer who was Armstrong's agent, too?
That's exactly the man, yes. He was quite an individual, quite a man.
So It's My Party was the very first side you recorded?
That's right. Quincy brought maybe 200 demo records to my house several Saturdays before we had gone into the studio. And because I had never sat and picked this kind of material before, the first record he put on for me was a song called It's My Party, and it was demoed by, I don't actually know who actually sang the song. And it was a very spirited little tune, and I liked it because there was something kind of rebellious in its attitude. And when it was over, Quincy said, well, what do you think of that little bit? So I said, well, I like it, but I don't know if it's, let's put it in the maybe pile. And after we went through 200 demos, we had one maybe, and it was It's My Party.
So what do you remember of that first recording session when you made It's My Party?
Well, the first thing I remember, which is so different from today, is we recorded four track. And I think most people know today that, gosh, we use 24, 32. Some people actually marry two machines and have 64 tracks. So the state of the art has greatly improved. This meant that we had two microphones basically hanging in the studio, strategically placed over the band. We had a third microphone in the center of all of the background singers, and there were about eight of them, and then I was in a little booth, and that was the fourth mic. So that was pretty much the setup. When we counted off, you heard everything that was going to be there. Today we layer a lot and we track a lot. Then you just went in and did it. When you walked out of the studio, you were pretty well mixed and knew exactly what everything sounded like.
Ms. Magazine, there was recently a piece with you and K.D. Lang having a conversation with each other.
Yes.
And you said that when you were a kid, you'd sing in front of the mirror, and you'd slick back your hair like Elvis.
Mm-hmm.
But when you finally walked out on stage in the spring of 1963, you went dressed like a nice little girl and performed as you were expected to.
Mm-hmm.
Can you compare what you wanted to look like when you started to performing with how you ended up looking?
Well, I still basically have a very, I'm very sound-oriented. Image, which has become a major part of our business, is not what I would call my primary interest. So what it was really was sort of this, and you can probably relate, let's say you had a party to go to, and I might compare it to having the Ed Sullivan show to do. I would say to my mother or my cousin, what do you think I should wear? And we would, you know, then go shopping for something we thought was appropriate. Because the only influence on my life at that time was my mother, I very often walked out looking sort of like my mini mother. you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I didn't have anyone saying to me, just put on a pair of jeans and a white shirt, which probably would have felt comfortable to me at the time, but I probably would have had a problem with it. Because I did believe you get up on stage and you dress up because there are lots of people there and it's important and you want to show yourself off to your best advantage. I'm a little bit more savvy now in terms of image, but at 16, you don't necessarily have a clear-cut image of yourself.
Well, if you're going shopping with your mother for performances, you're not going to end up looking like the Ronettes.
Exactly.
Singer Leslie Gore is my guest. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Sunshine, lollipops, and rainbows. Everything that's wonderful is what I feel when we're together. Brighter than a lucky penny when you're near the disappears, dear, and I feel so fine just to know that you are mine. My life is sunshine, lollipops, and rainbows. That's how
this... Leslie Gore is my guest.
So what did you do when you stopped having hits?
Well, I did continue through college, and I graduated. And I'd say the hits kind of stopped in 67. I graduated college in 68. So what I did was, I'm feeling kind of like a musician without a place to play, I began doing other things like summer stock and getting into other areas of my craft, not just singing, and not just singing on a stage, but singing as a character, and getting a bit more into acting. And I think that formative period in my life has probably stood me in the greatest stead, because today I get up on a stage and I do sing, but for me, singing is actually secondary. The singing is what I do and how I communicate it, but I'm not thinking about singing. I'm thinking about the situation in the song, and what happens is an intense identification with lyric, which comes out as acting.
Mm-hmm. Let me play something that's from the 60s, from an album called My Town, My Guy and Me. And this is a standard. This is a Julie Stein, Sammy Kahn song called The Things We Did Last Summer. Was it your idea to do a standard on this? I want to show a different side of your singing.
Probably. The very first album that Quincy and I did together, we had to base it on It's My Party, but we had to throw it together quite quickly, and it was called I'll Cry If I Want To, and it was all cry songs. It was Cry Me a River. It was the Johnny Ray's cry. So we had established a premise early on, whereby I would do standards, maybe with just a slight rock and roll edge. But by and large, I don't think of The Things We Did Last Summer as a rock piece. We did it, I think, just because I loved the song. I believe Don Costa did the arrangement, and a superlative one.
Okay, let's hear it. I think we'll hear a different side of your singing.
Sure.
The boat rides we would take, the moonlight on the lake, the way we danced and hummed our favorite song. The things we did last summer, I'll remember all winter long.
since the early 70s, have you been singing a lot on the oldie circuit? I guess there really wasn't an oldie circuit in the early 70s.
There wasn't, actually. The oldies really began coming back strong, I'd say, right after 1980. About 1980, 81, it really started to pick up. And I did, in fact, take advantage of it. And it certainly, actually during the 70s, no one wanted to hear Leslie Gore. I was writing my own material and working small clubs, tiny clubs, and doing mostly original material. So this whole nostalgia kick at least helped me out financially at a time that it was fairly grim for me. But I did, in fact, put the show together that I'm doing now at the Rainbow and Stars because you just can't do the same thing all the time. If you're an artist, you have to grow and you have to find new roads to grow. And for me, this was an opportunity to sing songs, in some cases, I've never sung. In some cases, songs that I was majorly influenced by as a kid. And just an opportunity to get up and show people that there is another side to me. As a matter of fact, maybe more important to show myself that there's another side of me.
Leslie Gore, do you know what's become of Susan Michaels, who was the president of the Leslie Gore Fan Club?
Yes, I do. Susan Michaels was an amalgam of my middle name, which is Sue, and my brother's first name, which is Michael. And it was actually my grandma, my Nana, who is no longer with us, who became Susan Michaels and would try to answer all the fan mail personally and handwritten. And that's who Susan Michaels was.
Oh, that's great. So when did the fan club officially break up?
Well, I'm trying to think. There is yet an official Leslie Gore fan club. About 15 years ago, a gentleman by the name of Jack Natoli, who lives in Paterson, New Jersey, asked if he could be the president, and we turned everything over to him, and he does an incredible job.
Well, Leslie Gore, we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. I enjoyed it.
Leslie Gore is singing at Rainbow and Stars in Manhattan through October 26th. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Well, Linda, there's a compromise on the civil rights bill.
Right, Terry. The president says he can enthusiastically sign it. The Democrats say that they're behind it 100%. Cokie Roberts will drop by to tell us how that happened all of a sudden. A couple of interesting interviews on the show. Mike Schuster in the Soviet Union has an interview with Edvard Shevardnadze. And I spoke earlier today with Natan Sharansky, who is the prisoner of conscience, who was released from the Soviet Union and has formed an organization for immigrants in Israel. We also have some more reports from Oakland, which apparently is now suffering from rain and mudslides.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Clarence Thomas is now Justice Thomas, but by many indications, the country and the government are still reeling from his confirmation hearings. Linguist Jeff Nunberg noted Thomas's remarks following the Senate vote and has these thoughts.
Having avoided saying anything controversial throughout the Senate hearings, Clarence Thomas was not about to stick his neck out the day after the confirmation vote. "This is a time for healing," he said, "a time for moving ahead together." It reminded me of what Christopher Hitchens said not long ago, that the true PC language is the rhetoric of political consensus. It's the sort of thing that Republicans always say when they win a nasty fight, and I suppose Democrats would say it too in the event they should win one. It's a dialect whose strongest epithets are words like divisive and politicized, and whose mantra is bring us together again. But the healing metaphor is special. It plucks a string deep in the collective memory of the right, in the old figure of the state as a creature of flesh and blood. It's what the Elizabethans called the body politic in a literal sense of the term, the corporeal counterpart of the head of state. The Elizabethans made a great deal of this in their passion to find a natural order in all things. They worked out the comparison in assiduous detail. The monarch was the head or heart of the state. His counselors were its eyes and ears. The arms were the craftsmen and warriors. The feet were the plowmen and laborers who supported the rest. So social distinctions were ordained by natural law, and duty to the state was a natural obligation. As one writer put it, God made all of the parts of the body to serve him, and all of the subjects in a kingdom to serve their king. Shakespeare used the image at the beginning of Coriolanus. Rome is suffering from a famine, and a company of mutinous citizens are met by the old patrician Menenius Agrippa. He tells them a fable about the revolt of the limbs against the belly. There was a time when all the body's members rebelled against the belly, thus accused it that only like a gulf did it remain in the midst of the body, idle and inactive, never bearing like labor with the rest. The belly answers that it is the source of all the body's nourishment. True it is, my incorporate friends, that I receive the general food at first, which you do live upon, and fit it is, because I am the storehouse and the shop of the whole body, but if you do remember, I send it to the rivers of your blood. What this is, in short, is an early gastrointestinal version of trickle-down. It's true that later ages haven't imagined the body politic in quite such graphic detail as this. It's become a more amorphous creature now. But the trope persists. You can hear it in the nostalgic yearnings for the earlier organic societies of rural England or small-town America, societies that seem to have grown rather than having been made. And it's there when people talk about dissent and disputation as processes that leave wounds in the social tissue. The idea is that in the natural state of society, all of its parts and members will be moving in organic harmony toward a single goal, like Roberto Clemente pedaling back after a fly ball to deep left. I suppose it's an appropriate metaphor if you believe that society is an organism ruled by natural law. But I have to say that I prefer the metaphor in the explicit versions of the Elizabethans. At least then you knew where you stood. As the healing proceeds, just where do we put the splints and suppositories? In the physiology of modern America, what exactly are George Bush and Clarence Thomas, and what are you and I? If we must have a body politic, let it at least be anatomically correct.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist associated with Stanford University and the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Joan Tui, and Amy Sallet, with Roberta Shurrock and Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we examine what's gone wrong with America with investigative reporters Donald Bartlett and James Steele. Their new series of articles reveals how the government policies of the 80s effectively robbed the middle class. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.